Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com. This week, the Oscar contenders have their coming out party at the Toronto Film Festival. Read all about them at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar, back from the Great White North in the Toronto International Film Festival. Matty, actually, since you joined the show last September, we've never been apart for this long, 2 weeks. How did you cope?
I held up fine, thank you.
You managed. Well, I come bearing gifts this week, a conversation with the great Canadian filmmaker Adam McGoyan, his new film Adoration played at Toronto. I'll also share my top five movies from this year's festival.
Plus, lots of good stuff, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Ari Hest, and our top five most anticipated fall movies.
But first, it's No Country for Dumb Men, our review of the new Coen Brothers film, Burn After Reading.
Madola found like this CD just lying in a locker.
On the floor there?
Yeah, and it's these files, man.
I'm not comfortable with this.
It was just lying there.
You should put up a note in the ladies' locker room.
Put up a note? Hello? Did anybody lose their secret CIA stuff? I don't think so.
Osborne? Osborne Cox? Who am I speaking to?
What you're engaged in is blackmail.
I'm a mere good Samaritan.
Give me the CD or bust the money!
Joel and Ethan Coen, directors of films such as Fargo, The Big Lebowski, and my co-host's number one rated film of last year, No Country for Old Men, are often grouped with Alexander Payne, director of Election and Sideways, and maligned as clever intellectual directors who revel in loathing or mocking their own characters. Now, I personally disagree with those assessments, but after seeing the Coens' latest film, Burn After Reading, I guarantee they're only throwing more fuel on the fire for their detractors to scream that the Coen brothers never put forth sympathetic characters. Brad Pitt and Frances McDormand play naive personal trainers at Hard Bodies, a fitness club on the outskirts of D.C. They come across a computer disk left in one of the locker rooms that may or may not contain classified information left behind by Osborne Cox, an embattled CIA analyst played by John Malkovich, whose marriage to Tilda Swinton is certainly on the rocks, no thanks in part to the Lothario Treasury agent played by George Clooney, who seems intent on sleeping with just about everybody. Tilda Swinton, actually, in press for this movie, described every character in this film as a monster.
Yeah.
And I think she's spot on. The question is, do we actually care about the fate of these monsters, or is this just another example of the Coens callously putting stupid characters through the ringer for their own sadistic pleasure?
It's a great question, and one that definitely does apply here. I'll be honest, I'm with you. I never really understood that criticism of the Coen brothers, or I understood where it came from, but always disagreed with it. And especially with a movie like Fargo, I thought anyone who thought the Coen brothers were just trying to mock those characters completely misread the film. So I always argued against it and defended the Coens, until now, that is, because I am having a hard time coming up with any reasons why I would want to rewatch this movie or recommend it to anyone. And I will admit, I'm definitely keeping this in mind, that I didn't get The Big Lebowski when it came out. I liked it a lot better than this film, Burn After Reading. I liked the performances. I thought it was hilarious in many parts, but I didn't love it. I was actually disappointed with it, with this stoner comedy following up Fargo, which I thought was much heavier material. And only upon repeated viewings have I realized the genius of Lebowski. So maybe that will happen with Burn After Reading. But no, to answer your question, I didn't really care about the fate of these monsters. And they are monsters, and that's fine. You can have characters where you're trying to mock them. There is a little bit of satire going on here, this kind of new type of Cold War paranoia going on. I know that they're trying to get into that, but I actually would say that the Coen brothers, maybe with the opening and closing of the film, they kind of suggest we're just ants scurrying around this ant farm. I'm not sure they want us to care.
Yeah, there's really sort of a juxtaposition going on within this film. Let me just start by saying, when you are a dumb person, you do not possess a self-awareness that you are a dumb person. So when you're an actor attempting to play a character that is dumb, the worst sin, Adam, the worst sin you can commit...
Teach me, Matty.
...is playing dumb.
Yeah.
Acting lesson number 47, you cannot play adjectives, you play adverbs. You cannot play sad, you cannot play smart, you cannot play happy. In fact, you don't play at anything. In this movie, I can almost go down the line and divide the cast into two teams. Actors that are playing dumb. Performances that are so over the top and alienating that I don't believe them for a second.
Can I play? Can we
play
this
exactly.
game?
Here we go. Okay, here. Let's go George Clooney.
George Clooney is on the over the top acting side.
Yes, yes. He tries to face twitch his way
yes.
to some kind of truth. I mean, honestly, it looks like his face is having a stroke about 30 times a minute.
Yeah.
What about Mr. Brad Pitt?
I would actually, Brad Pitt's tough because I think he's on that side with Clooney, but I actually believed him.
You did believe him?
I did.
See, I didn't. I thought he was so exaggeratedly goofy, especially just the way he sucked on that big 7-Eleven gulp that he had.
He's always got to have something in his mouth. He's Brad Pitt.
Why did he have to do that?
I don't know.
Why did he have to do that? And then you have the elegant, the wonderful, the phenomenal Frances McDormand, who unfortunately just phones this in.
Yeah, she's in that camp.
It's a Marge Gunderson light performance, and then she gets these brilliant emotional scenes about three quarters of the way through the film, and I had to sit back and say, you haven't earned any of this, because I didn't believe you.
No.
She had the most clearly defined stakes in the entire film. She knows what she wants, and I didn't genuinely believe
and
her performance at all.
And she's our most sympathetic character.
Yeah, exactly. And then you compare those, contrast those performances, those overstated performances, with those by Tilda Swinton, J.K. Simmons, and the absolutely criminally underused Dick Jenkins here, all of whom perspicaciously fill in their characters with such a richness and tone that allows for some really, truly, and empathetic moments. And there's two scenes at the end of this film that I really found heart-wrenching, but juxtapose with that look-at-me sort of frivolity of the rest of the film, it ends up being a mess. You cannot have your cake and eat it, too. You cannot have half of the team on board and the half out here in La La Land.
You're exactly right. I had a very similar reaction to the performances and what the Coen brothers, it seems, were trying to go for here. It just was uneven. And I will put on that side with the good performances, David Rash.
Oh, he's brilliant.
Who is great with those scenes with J.K. Simmons, who are listed, and this is noteworthy because, again, I think it gets to that parody aspect here going on. It's worth noting that they are credited as simply CIA officer and CIA superior. That's the roles they're playing here. But they are very good. Those moments are genuinely funny, and they do get it right.
Those scenes are the most Coen Brothers-esque scenes of this film, but ultimately that unsettled tone falls directly at the Coens' feet. We get it. These are silly people doing silly, inconsequential things, and they hammer that point home by bringing on their own Statler and Waldorf, J.K. Simmons and David Rash, to comment on how pointless and miserable everything we're watching really is. And those scenes are great. You can do that if the buffoonery that we're watching, even if it's pointless, even if it's meaningless, you can get away with that, with commenting on your own action. They do it, of course, in Big Lebowski, if that buffoonery is entertaining. And unfortunately, the criminal aspect of this film is it's just not that funny.
No, it's
not. It tries so hard to be hilarious. And there was that shocking introduction of the sexual proclivities of a couple of these characters. It just did not work at all. It fell completely flat, and it smacked of desperation.
Yeah, a little bit. I can see that. But there is something going on here thematically. I can't really wrap my arms around it or say I enjoyed it, but there is something going on with emasculated men here and emasculated characters, characters who are really looking for some connection, looking for some meaning in life. Mm-hmm. It isn't just total frivolity. They are trying to get at something, I think. But again, I couldn't really wrap my head around it. You do have lots of phallic symbols in this movie. You also have lots of phalli, if I'm remembering my senior year Latin correctly. You know, in addition to the symbols, you have direct phalli there. But, you know, again, these characters really were people that I couldn't invest in any way. And you mentioned the word stakes. We like to bring it up on the show. You talk about them here. What were they? I don't really know. Some serious things happened to a few of the characters, but it's an accident. So in the grand scheme of things, there's nothing really to feel invested in, feel like there's stakes, that these characters are really going to lose anything. And I'm with you. I actually wrote in my notes here that it was almost painful to watch Clooney and McDormand constantly contort their faces and try to make their dialogue scenes quirky and funny. And Clooney, I've never been a fan of. Frances McDormand, I've always been a fan of. I think she always finds her way around that. Here, she falls into the same trap, and she goes for a quirk, and I never bought a second of her character, unfortunately.
I didn't at all, and I think we got off to a really rough start. I actually like the opening credits. You can tell it's a spoof because they start with this sort of credits out of Enemy of the State, and then we zoom down into the halls of Langley.
Right.
Enter John Malkovich, stage right. And, you know, there's a cadence to the language of the Coens. They demand that you say the lines exactly as they're written.
Like Mamet.
Yeah, exactly like Mamet. Like A, every A, every there, every what. And that first scene between Malkovich and I think Rash is in there and a couple other CIA men,
right.
I really felt I was watching an opening rehearsal, like an early rehearsal of this. No one seemed to be on board. No one seemed to be picking up on where this language was going to take them.
No, I'm with you. And I really felt this was the first time I felt like the Coen brothers were parodying themselves a little bit. Characters trying to act like they were in a Coen brothers movie. That was the first time I've ever felt that way with them. I know other people have probably leveled that criticism against them, but I've never noticed it before until here. And also, I was disappointed with the way it was shot, especially following up Roger Deakins
and
No Country
Jay-Jun.
For Old Men. I mean, here, it's completely different material, obviously. It's a comedy. It's D.C., so it's urban. You don't have these great landscapes and whatever. But Emmanuel Lubezki, brilliant cinematographer, nothing to do here.
You struck at how much DC is not a character in
it's
this
true.
Film at all.
Yeah,
it really struck
me.
But I do have to say, it is a Coen Brothers film. There are some great supporting characters, and I just want to give them some credit. Alongside, we already mentioned David Rash, but Jeffrey DeMunn as the plastic surgeon has a great scene, and J.R. Horn as Tilda Swinton's lawyer.
Attorney, yeah.
Again, these are the guys. If you can actually invest in the language and fight for what you want, that's entertaining. That's a Coen Brothers movie, and about half of the people involved here were doing that.
Yeah. So if we're going to sum up this film, a big disappointment, Maddie? For me, it was.
Yeah, okay. It really was.
Well, Burn After Reading is out now in theaters everywhere. In fact, so much a disappointment that Intolerable Cruelty, which a lot of people think is one of the Coen brothers' worst, I think this movie makes Intolerable Cruelty look like Annie Hall by comparison. I really think that's a far superior film, and it does hurt me to say that. But again, it's out now in theaters everywhere. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, Massacre Theater and whether or not to kill yourself is one of the most important decisions a teenager can make. Find out which screen teacher said that memorable line next in Listener Feedback. Stay with us.
Stay. I could have chosen to stay. At least the world wouldn't look so gray. Here is an empty room filled with an empty man. A lot of time and money. Before you pull that shit with Fogarty, I was a shoo-in to take over when the boss croaked. A shoo-in. It was made very clear to me, Joey, I had to clean up your mess or nothing was ever gonna happen for me.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I perform really poorly,
yes,
a scene from a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, Adam, we massacred the scene you just heard between William Hurt and Viggo Mortensen from David Cronenberg's A History of Violence.
You mean A History of Violence, the number one film of 2005, A History of Violence?
Your number one, my number 74.
Yes, maybe so. Safe to say, actually, A History of Violence, I believe, is the most divisive film in the history of this show in terms of people either being wildly in favor of it, like myself, or absolutely hating it, kind of like you, Maddie.
You know, it's one of those films, I do have to admit, though, when I see it on cable television, it kind of engrosses me for scene or two. But then eventually I peter out. I cannot watch it all the way through to the
end. That is too bad.
All right. Well, why don't you reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Dylan Northrup from beautiful Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta, Georgia. You know, I've always considered New York the Atlanta of the North.
Really? I'd like to hear an explanation for that sometime, Maddie. Congratulations to Dylan. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Now, you guys gotta look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
And action.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. And Maddie, you like to use that adjective, beloved. I don't know, is this scene that does tie in with our review here this week on Film Spotting Burn After Reading, is this actually a beloved film by us or by listeners?
I'm not sure if it's that beloved, but there are a lot of very good tie-ins with this film.
There are, and I know there are some very ardent fans out there. Some people really do love this movie. So that's all we're going to say about it. Maddie, you're going to start it off. I'm going to give you the action. and action.
Helsinki is wonderful this time of year, isn't it?
Especially the snow. It affords one solitude, even in a city full of people.
I'm blank.
So I gathered.
You are...
Here you are, blank.
At least give me a made-up name. Something for me to cry out during the dark nights of the soul.
Cry out, Olivia.
That's Twelfth Night.
Very good, blank. I'm pleasantly surprised. You're not like the other murderers.
And scene. Yeah, that's pretty good stuff.
Not bad. I really liked your impression there, Maddie. If you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, September 17th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
Hey, I'm Maddie. It's Brody from Lexington, Kentucky, calling. I just want to say I'm on a Woody Allen binge, and I did see Vicky Cristina Barcelona this weekend. I thought it was really well done, and what I especially really liked was the performance of Rebecca Hall, who has not been in that many films, but she really impressed me, and hope to hear you guys' response to it.
Hi, film spotters. This is Jay from Bradenton, Florida. I really don't know what to say. Renaissance Man is... movie that made me want to be a teacher. Since then, everybody's told me that I'm a great teacher, I was born to teach, and I really not sure if that would have ever happened if not for movies like Renaissance Man and Dead Poets Society. Just felt like I had to get that off my chest.
We turn now to listener feedback, Maddie, and we start with a couple of voicemails there. We heard from Jay, responding to our top five screen teachers from a few weeks ago. It was a top five tying in with our review of the new Steve Coogan movie, Hamlet 2, kind of a play on those inspirational teacher movies. And I believe that what happened there with Renaissance Man, the Danny DeVito film, is you recalled the fact that it's one of only two movies I ever walked out on. And I said how much I hated that movie. Jay, very upset about that, says he wouldn't have been a teacher without Renaissance Man. That doesn't necessarily make it a good movie. If he went back and watched it now, I bet he'd see how treacly it is. And also Brody there with some love for Rebecca Hall in Vicky Cristina Barcelona, the Woody Allen movie.
You and I both liked Rebecca Hall from last year's Starter for 10,
yes,
which I think it's out on DVD now. People should really check that out.
Yeah, Brody did mention that there, and he was curious how we would respond. He obviously left that voicemail before our review, and we both did single her out in a movie that does have very good performances in it, that Woody Allen film. And it's also worth noting, I don't believe I found time to mention this during our discussion of that film, but Rebecca Hall also appeared in another film with Scarlett Johansson, her Vicky Cristina Barcelona co-star, and that would be Christopher Nolan's The Prestige.
Ah.
They're the two women vying for the love of Christian Bale's character. So Rebecca Hall, definitely a very young, talented actress. Our poll questions this week, we're actually going to hold off on our new poll questions, save it for after our top five, but we do have our poll results tying into Vicky Cristina Barcelona. We wanted to know why you would be interested in seeing that movie. Here are your choices. You like Vicky, Rebecca Hall. You like Christina, Scarlett Johansson. You like Barcelona and Javier Bardem and Penelope Cruz. It's getting decent buzz. I'll see anything Woody Allen does. Or people still go to Woody Allen films?
Well, as hard as we try, Adam,
I'm crushed.
As much as we are still acolytes for this guy, number one at 26%, people still go to see Woody Allen
Ouch.
Films. Close behind at 25%, I'll see anything Woody
Gives
Allen does.
Gives me a
does.
Little bit of solace
exactly.
there.
Exactly. And then if you go down the line and start to add it up a little bit, I like Barcelona, Bardem and Cruz, 21%. It's getting decent buzz, 20%. I like Christina, Scarlett Johansson's character, 6%. I like Vicky, Rebecca Hall, 1%. I think the more people meet Vicky and Rebecca Hall, the more people are going to tune in to see what she does next.
I agree, as well as Penelope Cruz and Bardem, who we know how great they are. And you really had a lot of praise, especially for Penelope Cruz's performance. So Vicky Cristina, though, a movie we're not going to be able to get into the feedback here on this show. Another very divisive film. People are really split on it, but everyone except me, everybody I've met in the world, thinks that voiceover, just like you, was awful and almost ruined the movie. I'm the only guy who defends it.
Yeah, exactly, because people have read my book. Never use a narrator in film. You don't need it.
Okay, a very good point. We could have a good discussion about that sometime. There are some movies that use narration well. Some of them may even be screen teacher movies as we transition into the mailbag here. We did do this top five back when we reviewed Hamlet 2 and got some really good responses, Maddie. This one will start with Galen in Menlo Park, California.
I listen to your podcast as I ride my bike to the California Public High School where I teach English. And one of my classes is a college preparatory film analysis class. So you guys are making an indirect contribution to my students' education, heaven forbid,
yes.
Adam. Here's my list, one that allows for some realism slash variation from the cliche. Ray Walston as Mr. Hand, we mentioned him, of course, Fast Times and Ridgemont High. Ryan Gosling as Dan Dunn in Half Nelson, we also mentioned him.
Yes.
And, of course, the great Robert Donat, not Richard Donat, as I called him, and Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Number two, Elizabeth Pena, the great Elizabeth Pena, as Pilar Cruz in John Sayles' Lone Star. Only a couple of classroom scenes, Galen writes in, but like most Sayles characters, she's the one teacher on this list who actually seems like teachers I know. And of course, then he goes on to add, the one choice I really think you guys overlooked and will concede to be on the list, Matthew Broderick as Jim McAllister in Election. Enough said.
Well, before we get to Matthew Broderick's character in Election, I do want to go back to Elizabeth Pena in Lone Star. Galen was the only listener who remembered her character in Lone Star. I completely forgot it. One of my favorite films from the 90s, and I really like to see a little bit of love for that character and that actress here on this list. But Matthew Broderick, we're certainly going to hear from another listener here in a second, and many wrote in. I think that was definitely the big oversight for most of our listeners that we left off Matthew Broderick. Did he come close to making your list, Maddie?
I definitely considered him, but I left him off because he never answered the question, what's the difference between ethics and morals.
Hmm.
And I think he is very recognizable as sort of a flawed human being. And our teachers are flawed, definitely. They can be. But he just didn't compete with some of these other great characters.
Yeah, for me too. I definitely considered him, was probably there in my top 10, just did not make the cut. But he did make the cut for our buddy Sean Lane in Chicago, who we had a chance to meet at our Chicago meetup a few weeks ago. This is his list of top 5 bad movie teachers, and there he is at number 5, Jim McAllister in Election. While the joy of this movie is that you don't blame McAllister for hating Tracy Flick, gaming student Elections is out of bounds and worthy of inclusion. Number 4, Joan Elizabeth Perkins in About Last Night.
Wow.
Probably a good teacher, but on this list because she was a slut outside of school. This changed the way I looked at my teachers, especially the single female ones.
No.
Number 3, Brother Thaddeus, Donald Sutherland in Heaven Help Us, sadistic Catholic monk. After seeing this film, I was never happier that I attended public school. Number 2, Pauline Fleming in Heathers, and this is really good. While every teacher at Westerberg High was completely clueless as to how to respond to an epidemic of student suicides, Ms. Fleming topped them all with one of my favorite movie lines of all time. Whether or not to kill yourself is one of the most important decisions a teenager can make. Absolutely. And number 1, perfect for this list, I think, Maddie, Sam Lombardo, Matt Dillon, and Wild Things.
Hi, Mr. Lombardo.
Hey, girls.
Look, he forgot. I knew it.
No, I didn't. Check out my Jeep. Nice and dirty for you. But you might want to wait till the other car leaves.
Fraud, extortion, murder, and a three-way with 2 female students. Not exactly teacher of the year material there, Sam. Indeed.
It's a complete guilty pleasure of mine. I do love Wild Things.
Yeah.
I love movies like Body Heat that sort of just unabashedly drip with sleaze and camp. And I remember the first time I saw Wild Things, it was actually on a VHS tape that I had rented. Well, there's one section of the tape that obviously had been rewatched and rewatched. The tracking button could do nothing.
Wow. That is kind of sad when you think about it, actually.
All right, well, let's move on to Gus Albuquerque, writing in from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. As always, your top 5 list was great, but not even an honorable mention to the great Jeffrey Jones as Mr. Rooney in Ferris Bueller's Day Off? Come on. The guy spends the whole movie chasing and getting outsmarted by a teenage kid. He gets beaten, bitten by a dog, physically tested and humiliated, but he never quits. Talk about not giving up. Talk about leaving a permanent impression. If the Terminator himself was a teacher, he would be Mr. Rooney.
Yeah, I really don't have a defense for that one. I mean, he is a great pick for this list, and I'm glad Gus recognized him. Other listeners did as well. And he is a principal, though, which
right.
maybe is a little different than being a teacher. I guess he's the teacher's boss, right, Maddie?
Yeah, and I love the chance to talk about the great Jeffrey Jones, and I was happy to see his career career, get rejuvenated a couple years ago on Deadwood. He's a great actor. He actually went to Lawrence University here in Appleton, and he cut his teeth as a member of the Guthrie Theater's acting ensemble in Minneapolis.
I did not know that.
And actually, one of his my favorite roles is as the Emperor in Ormond's Amadeus.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I remember him there, very good in that role. Let's close out this section of listener feedback, our screen teacher's reactions, with some thoughts on Dead Poets Society, which was actually my number one, even though I knew I was going to get grief for it. And I did get grief for it for many listeners, but at least a couple wrote in to defend it here. Justin McCumber said, Adam, stop it. Don't you feel bad for one single second. Dead Poets Society is a fantastic film, and let no one tell you differently. I write because of that film. I love poetry because of that film, and I hope to be an inspirational light for others because of that film. So let your love for that movie be undaunted, Adam. Oh, Captain, our captain is calling. We also got this one from Brett Sparta Merriman. I loved it when I was in high school. It made being yourself and looking at life from another perspective not just bumper stickers, but living, breathing ideals. It put carpe diem into the culture. The ending is one of the best I've ever seen. Perfectly set up and incredibly emotional without being manipulative. It got dusty in the theater then. It gets dusty in the living room now. Hell, it could get dusty on the iPod, Brett writes.
If the poem score for perfection is plotted on the horizontal of a graph...
Mr. Keating, they made everybody sign
it. Anderson?
You gotta believe me, it's true.
I do believe you, Tom.
Leave, Mr. Keating.
But it wasn't his fault.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson. One more outburst from you or anyone else, and you're out of this school. Leave, Mr. Keating.
Captain, my captain.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson.
I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of. Dead Poets Society, you had two people really at the top of their game. You had Robin Williams, who was in a string of films there, Dead Poets, Awakenings, Good Morning Vietnam, Mrs. Doubtfire, and Aladdin. But you had Peter Weir as well. He owned the 80s. Gallipoli, The Year of Living Dangerously. And he,
Witness?
Witness. And he would go on. Of course, I think the last thing he did, actually, he doesn't direct a lot. The last thing he did was Master and Commander. Mm-hmm. He is really good at entertainment blockbuster. He's right up there in sort of that Ron Howard school, maybe just a little bit of a cut above.
I would say he's probably a cut above, certainly with a movie like Master and Commander. He is a very good filmmaker. We also got some responses here we want to share to our top five from our previous show when we did our top five Canadian films. It was our preview of the Toronto International Film Festival, which we will get into here in a little bit more detail in the next segment. But some people writing in with some of their favorite films that are actually set there in Canada.
Well, David from, I'm just going to butcher this, Disregard, Denmark. Top five Canadian films, and you forgot Last Night from 1998. It's one of the most amazing end-of-the-world films ever made, a sharp contrast to the event films Hollywood spews out every summer. I love the calm, inevitable tone of this film. Stunning. This brings another flaw of your list to light. Don McKellar. He directed and starred in Last Night. He shows up in The Red Violin, Exotica, which showed up on your list, Adam, and the exquisitely stupid Way Downtown from 2000. But you didn't even mention him. Still a great show, guys. I just love to disagree with you.
Yeah, and we can't forget the film Last Night because we've never seen Last Night.
But I certainly didn't forget Don McKellar because he starred in my number four film, Highway 61, as Pokey Jones. And he has this great bit of dialogue with his co-star, Jackie Bangs. She says, I can see why they call you Pokey. He says, I can see why they call you Bangs.
Very nice. And there was some more love for Don McKellar from our listener, Graham. Somewhere in Alberta, Canada, also had a lot of love for Don McKellar. Actually said that his role in that movie, Way Downtown, gives the Milton character, Stephen Root's performance in Office Space, a run for his money. I don't know about that, but that movie, along with Last Night, one that we need to check out. And our last emailer here, Denise in Toronto, Ontario, she writes in with another one we need to check out. She says, I really appreciated your top five list of Canadian films. You had some really great picks in there, Black Robe and Exotica in particular. You've also gotten me excited about Guy Madden's My Winnipeg. All that being said, I'm afraid that I must point out one glaring omission. It's true, guys, you messed up by not including Crazy, or C-R-A-Z-Y, the coming-of-age story of a boy coming to terms with his sexuality in Quebec during the 70s and 80s. This exceptional film is one of the best films, Canadian or otherwise, that I have ever seen. When I heard that you were putting this list together, I just took it for granted that it would make the cut, so I was pretty surprised that it eluded your radar. Am I safe in assuming that you haven't yet seen it? Yes, you are safe in assuming that.
She is very safe, and she actually echoes a sentiment. I actually have dear, dear family friends that live up in Winnipeg. We would go up and see them every summer, and I love them. They would make me recite the provinces of Canada and the territories. And, of course, I would get candy if I recited them correctly. They were very proud of their Canadian history and heritage, and why shouldn't they be? But they listened to the show, and they mentioned this movie,
they did.
Crazy. And they also mentioned another film. It's called Pierre Trudeau and the Me Generation, the 70s generation. It's a documentary that came out in the mid-90s, unfortunately not available on Netflix, but they're sending me a copy to check out.
Oh, good. And then you can pass it on to me. And Denise does note that if we or our listeners are interested in learning more about this film, Crazy, don't read the Wikipedia entry. Apparently, it's got a major spoiler in the first paragraph. So a good note there to pass on.
Well, you know, you and I, we said last week on the show, next year we're going to do this list again, and we are going to catch up with all these titles.
Yeah, I really do look forward to that. Thanks to everyone, as always, for the great feedback. If you have any thoughts you want to send to the show, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net, or you can leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
Time for another quick break. A week after we named one of his films our favorite Canadian movie of all time, Adam got a chance to sit down with writer-director Adam Egoyan. That conversation and Adam's Toronto Film Festival wrap-up is next. Stay with us. Secret keeper, legend has it, you are good. If it's true, then I won't have to knock on wood. It's your calling, I am handing you the reins to take control. Take the reins, don't use that.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and it's time now for my Toronto International Film Festival wrap-up. Maddie, 3.5 days there, 20 movies, 2 interviews, 1 Film Spotting meetup. I managed to fit all of that in somehow this year.
Better you than me.
Yeah, well, I look forward to having you there again next year. It will be a lot more fun to have someone to festival with, though I did get to hang out with guys like Michael Phillips quite a bit and Scott Tobias, various Chicago film critics who have been guests on this show. And I do want to thank everyone who came out, including our buddy Matt Singer from IFC News, and who made his debut on At the Movies at the Critics Roundtable last week. And if anybody caught that, he managed to make it out to our Film Spotting meetup in Toronto at the Bedford Academy, just like last year, Maddie, where we got to hang out with some of our listeners. It was really great to meet guys like Jason Eakin.
Emphasis
from,
on guys.
Yeah, all guys. No women again made it out this year. I don't know. Where was Denise from Toronto, Maddie? That's what I want to know, who we heard from in the last segment. But longtime listeners like Jason Eakin from Kansas City was there. Corey Attad. I've been pronouncing his name wrong all these years as Corey Attad. He's from Toronto. He made it out. It was really just a good time. Again, about 9 or 10 of us got to hang out, have a few drinks, and have some food and talk about movies. Good times.
Do any of these people hang out on the Film Spotting message boards?
Yes, Maddie. Actually, a few of them do, I know. Especially Corey is one name I recognize who hangs out on our board. So you want to check those guys out, check out some stuff from our meetup and from Toronto, you can do that at filmspotting.net/boards.
All right. That's all well and good. But
yes.
Number one, I want to know, did you see Paris Hilton?
I did not see Paris Hilton. I think she maybe showed up after my time there. I unfortunately only got a chance to spend 4 days there, 3.5 days total there in Toronto. So I didn't get to hang out with Paris Hilton. No, but I did have some other celebrity encounters, if you will, celebrity encounters. Our buddy Ryan Johnson, friend of the show, the director of Brick and The Brothers Bloom, which premiered there at the festival, had a chance to have breakfast with him on Sunday morning. That was a great conversation, finally getting to meet him. He's been a guest here on the show, obviously. We heard that interview we replayed last week. Also, two directors, Jason Reitman and Spike Lee, I stood about 2 feet from for multiple minutes and could not muster the courage to say anything to either of them.
I think they hang out on our message boards, too.
Maybe so. I'm sure they do. I was so afraid that Jason Reitman, not that he has any idea who I am or who Film Spotting is, but there was still that part of me that was like, if I say something to him like, hey, I'm a big fan of your films, which I am, he would then turn to me and go, yeah, aren't you the guy who said I didn't deserve an Oscar nomination because I'm not an auteur? And so
nice.
I decided I should just hold back and not say anything to him.
All right. Well, we're going to get to the good stuff here in your top five from the festival. But I want to know, what about the disappointments? Was there anything you were really looking forward to seeing and you ultimately found lacking?
Yeah, there were two that would stand out as mild disappointments. Two directors, again, who we replayed interviews with last week on the show. The first being Michael Winterbottom. His new film, Geneva, was there at the festival. I liked it, but was not the experience I was hoping for. He is a director I really like.
And that's what you're always hoping for with a Michael Winterbottom film, is an experience. That's what you want.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this one just wasn't quite what I would hope for from him. I can't get into it, as I'm sure we're going to discuss it on a later show. And also Richard Linklater's new film, Me and Orson Welles, with Zac Efron from High School Musical as this aspiring actor who gets involved in the Mercury Theater's production of Julius Caesar. A fine movie, but just not one of those great Linklater films. I don't think it's going to go anywhere near the pantheon of some of his other films that I really love.
Well, those great Linklater films, we're getting further and further removed from them. You were too kind to Fast Food Nation.
I still really like that movie, but he also did make The Bad News Bears that same year, I think. But maybe so. This is a decent movie, as is Geneva, just not some of my favorites. And then there were some major disappointments I do briefly want to mention. And again, I know we're going to discuss at least one of these films in detail on the show later, but Appaloosa. This is the Western directed by Ed Harris. It stars Ed Harris, Viggo Mortensen, and Jeremy Irons, three of my favorite actors. Renee Zellweger's in it. It starts out fantastically, and then, for me, pretty much becomes a train wreck. It's a very poorly directed and poorly written film. I was very disappointed by it. And also, Ashes of Time Redo. This is Wong Kar-wai's new film. It's a redux version of his own film, Ashes of Time, made, you know, at least a decade ago. I can't remember exactly when it was made. And it was just a disappointment. I was actually scheduled to talk with Wong Kar-wai. I was going to interview him and then had to cancel it due to a conflict. And I didn't feel all that bad about it, even though I really did want to meet him and talk with him. I didn't have a whole lot to say about that movie. So that was a disappointment. I forgot, Maddie, though, I did want to mention as well some surprises. There was one big surprise from this festival. JCVD, shot in Brussels, Jean-Claude Van Damme playing a version of himself that has a field day subverting his image as an action star and a celebrity. Jean-Claude Van Damme, I'm here to tell you, can actually act.
I cannot wait.
Yeah, you really have to check it out.
All right, well,
it's really good.
When you go to festivals, I mean, really, they are hit or miss. I mean, sometimes you can be stuck in a movie that goes nowhere. And Adam, you're reticent to walk out on those films. So I want to know, was there enough good stuff to compile an actual top five list?
There was, though this year I actually did walk out of a movie. There was a film. I finally just got fed up and left. I had to do it. So,
you know, ladies and gentlemen, you know it's a bad film when this guy, when the most patient man in history,
walks
out.
I can't say I've seen it if I haven't seen all of it. That's at least my philosophy. But I had to leave. But
automatically, it's up there with Renaissance Man.
Yeah, that's it. But I did have some movies I love from the festival here. I'm actually going to start with my top four. And again, going to be brief here, just give you some of the things I liked, not get into the plot details, because we are going to review these films in the coming months on the show. And you can find information online by doing a Google search. But my number four movie would be Synecdoche, New York, the new Charlie Kaufman film. Of course, the writer of movies like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and Adaptation. This is his first time as a director. It's a lot less funny than those movies in a lot of ways. It's also even more strange and absurd and depressing and bleak, and it's bizarre, but I was fascinated by it. I think really strong directing from Kaufman, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, as you would expect, is very good in the movie. So that's my number four. My number three is the new Jonathan Demme film, Rachel Getting Married. Like Synecdoche, it comes out in October.
Oh my God!
You look great.
Oh no, I'm so fat.
Stop it.
No, you... I would swear to God that you were puking again.
You know, I can really see rehab has done wonders for you, Kim.
Hi. Darling, hi. Is your sister behaving herself?
I'm not exactly sure what that means.
I am Shiva the Destroyer, and your harbinger of doom for this evening.
It's going to be perfect.
Demme here is doing what is essentially a Dogma film. It's a lot like Thomas Vinterberg's The Celebration, where it's shot handheld and digital. The ensemble cast, though, is amazing, including the star of it, Anne Hathaway. I'm here to tell you, Anne Hathaway is going to get an Oscar nomination for Rachel Getting Married. And everyone at the festival, including myself, kept calling it Rachel at the Wedding because it reminds you of Margot at the Wedding. And in a lot of ways it is, but everything we didn't like about that film, Maddie, I would argue is remedied here in Rachel Getting Married. Good stuff from Jonathan Demme. Number two, Happy Go Lucky, another October release. This is the new Mike Leigh film, the director of Naked and Secrets and Lies. Improvisational, it's an ensemble again. It's very much a Mike Leigh film. It's dealing with hot-button cultural and socioeconomic issues, but in a very funny way, not didactic, with a really great lead performance by Sally Hawkins. I can't wait until you see it. And my number one, another movie, Maddie, that I can't wait till you see. Unfortunately, there's no U.S. release date set for it, but it's Hunger. This is the story of the 1981 IRA hunger strike in Northern Ireland's Mays Prison. It was led by Bobby Sands. The director, Steve McQueen, is a very popular artist, has worked in film before, but this is his first feature movie, and this is just unflinching. It puts you in that prison. At Cannes, it got standing ovations and walkouts, so it gives you a sense of what the experience is like. There's very little dialogue. It's all told with the camera. If you liked WALL-E, this is like the horrifying version of WALL-E, where so much of it is told with visuals, but then you've got a 22-minute dialogue scene, 28 pages of script, Maddie, at the core of this film between a priest and Bobby Sands. The two actors are Michael Fassbender and Liam Cunningham, and it's all done in one take. 22 minutes. He gave him four shots to do it with. I actually had a chance to talk with Steve McQueen, did interview him there at the festival, and we'll hear that interview at a later date. But I think Hunger is a must-see for any actor, writer, or director, and I really do look forward to you, Maddie, as an actor and a writer, seeing that film and getting your reaction to it.
All right, so we got your ones through four. What was your number five?
Well, my number five, I cheated a little bit, got a little bit of a tie. I'll just mention The Brothers Bloom, the new Rian Johnson film, is in there, and it's a tie with the new Adam Egoyan film, Adoration. And they are very different films, but they're also similar in that they both explore how we construct our identities. And I caught up with Adam Egoyan in Toronto, the city he now calls home, to discuss this movie, Adoration. It's a film about a Toronto high school student who was encouraged by his drama teacher, also his French teacher, to present as truth this narrative he's created involving his dead parents and a failed terrorist act.
You live with your uncle. Does he know about this project?
I don't think he'd get it. He wasn't really raised to be tolerant about this sort of thing.
Maybe people really should stick to their own kind.
That's how you were raised?
Your uncle's an angry man.
Oh, yeah?
That's the thing about anger. It sucks up a lot of intelligence.
When I got back, it was done. I walked in, my father screaming that he did it on purpose.
This is your 12th feature film, and Adoration certainly bears your mark in many ways, stylistically, I think, and thematically, but I'm curious if there was anything new here with this film, whether stylistically or thematically, you were trying to explore.
Well, it is really quite a personal film, and it's quite direct, and what I'm trying to explore, I guess, is the roots of why we get attracted to telling stories, in a way. The main character is 15, and I was 15, certainly, when I discovered drama, and I found that there was this possibility of rearranging facts and trying to find a way of dealing with issues that I had to confront through making up stories. So the character of Simon, in this case, is in high school drama and creates this character for himself, which he then takes to the net, and it kind of explodes in a way that he could never have anticipated. And I found that part of the story really powerful for me, because it was going back to something that I remember, and yet I was a kid in a very different time. You know, we didn't have this ability, you know, writing a high school drama to connect with a global audience. And I wonder how my life might have changed if I had the opportunities that Simon has. He has a very particular history. He comes from this history of suppressed kind of violence within his own family, and he finds a way of exploding that into a story that's outside of him, but which other people believe. It's kind of like a version of Never Cry Wolf, I suppose, in the internet age.
What's really interesting to me, and I've found that when I'm at various festivals, certain themes, motifs crop up, and this idea of this juxtaposition of reality and fantasy and characters using drama to create their own narrative and cope with life in some way has actually come up, maybe most directly in your film, but I've seen it six or seven times so far at this festival, and this is kind of an abstract question, but your film deals with abstraction, so maybe you can touch on this. Do you think that's specific to the time we're living in? Do you think that makes sense, or is it somehow just coincidence that these films all have this connection?
Well, in the case of Adoration, I mean, I do think we are surrounded by these narratives of violence, and we have to kind of find our way through navigating and trying to situating ourselves, and very often that means imagining what if? I think that, you know, most films are trying to deal with the idea of emotions as they are, but a film like Adoration is certainly dealing with the notion of, you know, emotions as they would be or could be if this had happened. So a film lends itself to this exploration because you're so immediately immersed in this alternate reality. When you see a moving image, you believe it's real, and it's quite effortless. And because of the way you structure film, you can float in and out of this imagined reality quite effortlessly. Now, I haven't, you know, unfortunately, the problem with having a film in a festival is you don't get to see the other films, and I don't have the perspective that you have, but that's interesting. And I think that it's, yeah, we are living in a moment where anyone can present a narrative on the internet, and we have to assess its veracity. I mean, or you have a situation like you had a few months ago in Florida where this young woman, I remember, was accused this guy of raping her, and he was found innocent, and she was just so outraged, and she put her story on the net, and she basically said, believe me, this happened. And it had like hundreds of thousands of hits. And I guess the thing that occurred to me is everyone was trying to assess whether or not she was true, being real. You know, and so, you know, this idea of things being made up and being, you know, put out there and having to decide whether or not something is entertaining, engaging, or whether or not it's actually presenting a reality has been a condition of our time for quite a while now.
I want you to work on this. I want you to present it next week to the class. I want everyone to believe it's true that you are this couple's child.
Why?
As an exercise.
An exercise in what? I'm not sure if my French is that good.
Then do it in English.
But you teach French.
And drama.
I'm not in drama.
Well, you are now.
And something you have dealt with in your films, in kind of a stylistic convention, I guess, a little bit, is the unreliable narrator. And here maybe we don't have directly a narrator, but someone who we're seeing Simon's vision of these stories that he's heard in his head, and we have to rely on that kind of subjective reality. And there's also something where I've noticed throughout your work where there's kind of that signature crime, if you will, or event from the past that determines the whole series of events that we see unfold, that they're trying to deal with. And I guess I'm just curious if you can talk about where that fascination comes from.
Oh, that comes from a lot of places. I mean, it comes from a lot of places personally, but it also comes from a lot of places culturally. I'm Armenian, and so there was a genocide in 1915, which the perpetrator has never actually acknowledged, being the government of Turkey. So, you know, having to navigate through that huge bit of collective history and the notion of what it is one is trying to extract as truth, and how almost 100 years later, I mean, you really do realize that truth is very often how people somehow accommodate varying views of the same event. You know, like it's a very, very murky territory, which makes it fascinating as a dramatist. And yes, it's true. I mean, I hadn't thought of it that way, but there's very often a central event or a crime. Very often there has been a judgment passed at that moment, but that judgment is not enough for these characters to actually thrive on. They need something else, and they need to find out more and find out and deal with their own trauma very often. So yeah, I think that those are that is a trend. I mean, what's interesting when you talk about an unreliable narrator is that in this case, you know, especially for the first half of the film, I think, you know, it's structured in such a way that there's also something within the film, and maybe not just particular to Adoration, many of the films, where the structure itself invites this idea of unreliability. You know, that there is something which film in itself, you know, it's going to unspool and be projected in a certain way. Yet within that, there seems to be this strange sense of things being either tangible or on tangents. You know, like, you know, there's just various ways that these things could be pieced together. You know, it's not something that I do consciously. It's just the way these stories come out. And I understand it's always interesting to get responses because people sometimes find them difficult. And for me, there's an emotional clarity. I mean, actually, the stories are very often quite simple. Once they're resolved. But I am fascinated by putting the viewer in the state of mind of the characters, you know, and trying to sift through this history as they are trying to play it out themselves. And that might be challenging, but it's also, I think, really exciting when the viewer is able to be exploratory and trust what I'm up to, certainly.
We're here on Film Spotting talking with Adam McGoin about his film at the Toronto International Film Festival, Adoration. There are a lot of themes being dealt with here, and it is in many ways a heavy movie, though you're right that the narrative is simple in a lot of ways. But it did occur to me that on some level it seemed that the theme, if there was, or a message in some ways, is just that a lot of angst and a lot of trouble here and tragedy in some ways could have been avoided if people simply were willing to engage each other and communicate with each other. If someone answered that phone call, you know, there are a lot of little moments like that where if someone maybe didn't withhold some information and gave a little bit more, a whole lot of trouble would have been avoided.
Yeah, but I think that's very often, I mean, huge historical moments are actually very often triggered by the most inconsequential, tiny moments. You know, someone just took an extra moment to understand something, and that to me is such an overwhelming concept. You know, we have this idea that there are these grand shifts, and I think Erat was sort of dealing with that, certainly, that, you know, for all, you know, that was a film within a film, and it was the making of a big historic epic, which somehow was going to change the world view about whether or not this moment of history happened. But the real shifts in history within the film happen in meetings between individuals. You know, like that there are certain accommodations that are made, and people actually have conversations, and that really history is not passed by these grand gestures, but in the narratives that are told from parents to children, and that those children then tell to their children. And it you know, I think that is the most exciting thing about drama, is that ultimately there is an inherent mystery of any meeting between two people and what has to be negotiated in order to understand and empathize with someone else. That to me is in some ways the pillar of our civilization, is this ability to feel compassion and not to abstract, you know, someone else. You know, and there's very often reasons why we would. I mean, this, you know, the event that you're talking about, the phone call, is happening in the weeks after 9/11. You know, it was a dinner scene. And I remember those conversations. I remember, you know, the things that people were saying, the broad blanket statements. And, you know, and for that family, you know, to have been in the middle of that at that particular moment could have ended in, I think, quite realistically, in a tragedy like the one you see happening in the film. Though that being said, I mean, it's also, you know, we're talking about people creating drama. You know, that you have a number of characters in this film that have created dramas. You have, you know, obviously Simon, the kid who's creating this drama about himself, which he tells his friends, and which, you know, he actually makes other people believe. You have Sabine, the school teacher, who's creating this weird character for herself as a way of getting entrance to this house, ultimately. I mean, she comes with one agenda, but you realize it's something quite different. But then I think Scott Speedman's character, who really, at various points in the film, says that he's not into drama, that he seems to be a very simple, basic guy. But you realize he's created the most elaborate strategy when all is said and done. You know, this whole thing with the phone call. I mean, so people create these strange stratagems in ways that they don't even understand themselves. You know, very often, I mean, I think one of the most, you know, moving moment for me is when Scott says, you know, I know it's not my fault. And he's actually confronted with the fact that, well, it is your fault. You know, and I think it's very often to say that, you know, certain things would have happened otherwise. But it's really tough to say, actually, it was that simple gesture. It was that call that you didn't take. Or it was this crazy little thing that actually... And then the real question comes back to what you were saying before. Once you venture into that idea, where do you then go? Once you actually say it was my fault, I mean, does that solve the question? Or someone else says to you, you know, this is the truth, or this is this, you know, you are being charged with this, or someone else is being charged with this, you know, particular responsibility. Does that solve something?
You're absolutely right. It's a really bracing moment in the film when Sabine says that to Tom, because we don't have people say that to us very often. They always try to reassure us. They always try to tell us it's okay. It's not your fault.
But she's a provocateur, right? She clearly comes from a place where, you know, she has come to understand that you have to actually provoke these things. And certainly her whole project. I mean, this whole crazy thing. And I think, again, it's very often in this film, things are not what they seem, but they're not what they seem, not particularly for the reasons you think they're not what they seem, you know. So, you know, this whole thing that she engages the boy in as sort of a school project, you know, to test the uncle, for her to kind of dress up in this, you know, costume, you know. You think it's because she's trying to teach the boy that his uncle is a racist, or that he, you know, he's not tolerant, but that's not the reason why she's there at all. She has this whole other history, you know, which kind of, you know, reveals itself. So, yeah, I mean, I think she is a very complex and quite disturbed character. I mean, I think that there's something that's kind of unhinged about her, really. And I think she understands that at one level, but she still, you know, has to be who she is.
You mentioned Scott Speedman, and this cast here has a lot of familiar faces from your work, but also some new faces, Devin playing Simon and Scott Speedman as Tom. He was really a revelation for me here. I wasn't familiar with his work too much before, and I'm just curious if you can talk about the process of casting him and working with him.
With Scott?
Yes.
Well, I mean, Scott, yeah, it was a surprise for me as well. I mean, I was familiar with his work, but really through, you know, this huge TV series he did, Felicity and Underworld, and, you know, like, he wasn't really the person I had in mind as I was writing it. I was actually thinking that it would be an older character. And he got a hold of the script, and he was a fan of my stuff, and he flew himself up here and said, you know, let me read. And the moment he read, I was really affected, because in the original script, Tom was the person who had given up his 30s to look after his nephew. But, of course, it's actually a lot more moving to have someone who's given up their 20s, who's given up their youth, and is sort of dealing with that. And it makes the relationship between Simon and Scott much more about, like, they're almost like brothers, you know, as opposed to him being sort of a father figure. And I thought that really worked well. And I think it is, you know, new territory for Scott. I actually had seen him in a Spanish film that Sarah Pauly was in called My Life Without Me, and he played her husband, and he was really, it was very touching in that as well. Sometimes casting takes you in very, very unexpected ways.
You did that.
You got him to post that stuff about his dad being a terrorist. You did that?
I had absolutely no idea he would go that far.
Well, he took it that far.
Yes, I know. And I'm very sorry about it, but it was not my intention. Please.
Do you know what you've done to that kid?
I wouldn't have...
Do you know?
The movie is gorgeously shot, not surprisingly, but it was interesting to me that it's shot on film, and this is a movie with all the internet chatter we get and the way it explores new technology. It seemed like it could be a case where it might fit to be a little less formal with it, maybe get digital. Why did you decide to keep it on film?
It's exactly that. It's this idea that there's a texture that we now associate with the digital feature that I think doesn't necessarily frame the digital image in a way that allows us to concentrate on the oddness of that screen. And maybe it's also because, you know, there was a reference made within the film. I mean, I was dealing with some of these issues before in terms of the way we relate through monitors in the late 80s, like films like, you know, Family Viewing and Speaking Parts. And at that time, you know, people, the idea was satellite communications. But it's interesting that now, 20 years later, we're still actually using the same texture. We're still looking at other faces on monitors. But there's something about seeing that face on a monitor framed in a really lush, rich, saturated setting, which makes it more, gives it, well, a frame, you know, and allows us to concentrate on it in a different way than if we are completely inundated by that texture, as you would be if you had shot it, you know, digitally. That being said, you know, to be honest, I think this might be one of the last things I'm going to shoot on film, just because, you know, we're now getting at a point where, you know, well, I don't know about shooting on film, but I cut the negative here, and that was just ridiculous. I had this whole idea that I wanted to keep this old system, but, you know, no one cuts film negative anymore, and we had to deal with the consequences of that, which were horrifying, because, you know, the negative cutter hadn't cut a feature for a year, and, you know, just, you know, there was so much, I won't even get into the technical problems, but, you know, you realize that, you know, this is as beautiful as that medium has been, and archivally as important as it is, it has become antiquated.
Well, I wish we had more time, because The Sweet Hereafter is one of my favorite movies, and the Russell Banks novel is one of my favorite books of all time. And speaking of that, as a preview to the Toronto Film Festival on my show a few weeks ago, my co-host and I counted down our top 5 Canadian films, movies that were set in Canada, not just directed by a Canadian, or shot here. And The Sweet Hereafter was both our number one pick. And I wanted to ask you, though, as a Canadian filmmaker, what would you put atop your list? What's a film for a neophyte Canadian film fan, someone trying to come to this country's work? What would be one or two films that you would say you got to start here?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would say, have you seen The Grey Fox, Philip Borsus's film?
I have not.
Yeah, that's a really, really great film. I'd say a really important Canadian film for me anyway. I mean, I would say there's a whole raft of films from Quebec, you know, and which are amazing. Like the early Denis Arcand films are also really good. I mean, the stuff that you know, like before Jesus in Montreal and the ones that kind of got more recognition, those are really, really great. You've seen all the early David Cronenberg movies, because those got a lot of distribution in the States, but they are pretty amazing to revisit. I guess maybe with the Barry gem is this film called My Uncle Antoine. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't, but many of my listeners have mentioned it.
Yeah, it's sort of considered here as being one of the top Canadian films ever made by Claude Jutra.
Well, I look forward to checking it out, and congratulations on the film. Best of luck with it. It was really a pleasure to get to talk with you.
Yeah, the same. Thank you.
My thanks again to director Adam McGoyan for his time in Toronto. Really one of my favorite interviews I've done here on Film Spotting. Unfortunately, Adoration does not currently have a set U.S. release date, but we will definitely let you know where you can find it as soon as we hear it.
All right, looking forward to it. Time for one last quick break. Up next, Adam, what do Oliver Stone, Clint Eastwood, and Kevin Smith have in common?
They have all never stepped foot in my kitchen.
Yes, and they are all vying for a spot on our top 5 most anticipated fall movies. Stay with us.
Don't you get too close. Make a mental note. Something's gonna give if you wait this time out. A penny strikes the well. Sinks down to the bottom. So much weight to bear. A quick fix, so don't you dare back down.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD. And since we were off last week, Maddie, we're going to mention here movies that came out just this past Tuesday and also movies coming out this Tuesday, the 16th. And we do have to start with The Big Lebowski 10th Anniversary Edition. Unfortunately, it doesn't have commentary by Joel and Ethan Coen, but there's two new features, The Dude's Life and The Dude Abides, The Big Lebowski 10 Years Later, plus The Lebowski Fest, An Achiever Story. So all sorts of extra features there. That's really too bad, though. No commentary. I'm not shocked, but I would have liked to hear the Coen brothers weigh in on The Big Lebowski.
They are very, very reluctant on all this stuff. Remember their Oscar acceptance speech last year, how terse it was?
They were just ready to get off the stage.
Exactly.
Thank you, and let's go. Also out now, some new movies we've reviewed on the show and some we haven't, such as Snow Angels, a movie from Sundance, actually 2007. Maddie, you need to check this movie out.
Right.
David Gordon Green.
Wait, this is from the director of Pineapple Express,
it is,
right?
It is.
Oh,
so
I cannot wait.
You really can't wait. The Fall is out now. It has audio commentary from the director, Tarsem, and plus commentary with the writer, producer, and the actor, Lee Pace. This was a movie we both liked but didn't love. Some of the performances, though, really good in this movie, made our end of the year list.
I think it's actually a very good family film and a good companion to the next one coming out, Speed Racer.
That's right. Maddie Robinson, one of the few critics out there that actually likes Speed Racer. And of course, I should correct myself. I mentioned performances, not end of the year, but our movies of the year so far, our performances of the year so far, we really did like the young actress, Kantinka Untaru, was that her name? Can't believe I remembered that, but she was in The Fall. And you're right, Speed Racer is out now. Our buddy Sam Smith in Nashville, Maddie, is also a big apologist for this movie. He thinks it's brilliant.
Apologist. Yeah. You mean fan. You mean diehard fan.
Well, when everyone else hates it, you can't wait to take it in.
I can't wait to see it. Okay. I'm expecting this for Christmas.
Okay. Well, now I know exactly what I'm getting you. Young at Heart, this was a big hit at Sundance, I believe, about elderly choral singers. That movie is out now. Everyone seems to love it, so I guess we'll have to check it out. And diving into the archives here a little bit, movies previously released, Cool Hand Luke, one of my all-time favorite films. That's out now. It
and
has
we have
commentary.
To send, we have to send our love out to Paul Newman and his family. He's not doing very well in his health right now.
That is unfortunate to hear. He's brilliant there in that role. And Rashomon, the Kurosawa film, the Essential Art House release. Risky Business, going back to the 80s now, the 25th anniversary release. And then 16 Candles, the flashback edition, and Weird Science, the flashback edition. So for you John Hughes fans out there, and I am one of them, we can check out those flashback editions now.
All right, well, it's time now for donations. We want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, Adam and I are truly, truly humbled by each and every donation. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much to our gold-level donor, Adam, from Chicago.
It wasn't me.
Okay, I was going to say.
No.
All right.
I give enough to this show.
Yes, you do. We also want to thank Peter from Upminster, Essex, UK. Joanne from Melbourne. There, Victoria, Australia. It's crazy. It's
and
crazy.
Joanne has been a strong
now.
Supporter of the show. Thank you.
Howard from Toronto, Ontario.
Actually, who I had a chance to meet up with at the Film Spotting Meetup during the Film Festival. Very nice to meet Howard. Thank you for your donation.
And Daniel from Peterborough, Cambridgeshire, UK. I think these people in the UK just donate to laugh at me having to read these incredible addresses.
I think you did that one right, though.
All right.
I think you did.
We'll see. Lucas from Wausau, Wisconsin. Beautiful Wausau, Wisconsin. Dana from Ottawa, Ontario. You were there earlier this year. Patrick from the greatly named Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Also in Altoona, Iowa, Maddie.
That's right. Daryl from Washington, D.C., Evan from Stratford, Ontario, Jonathan from Boulder, Colorado, and Dane.
Here's your chance.
All right, here we
go. Here's your chance to blow it, Maddie.
Damon from Dunedin, New Zealand.
That's probably how I would have said it, so I think you did a nice job, but
like
who knows?
This is like a Dunedin, Florida, I think.
Maybe.
We'll go with that. Thank you to everybody. And remember that for every $10 you donate, your name is entered into that film spotting hat, which is brimming full right now.
It is.
At the end of the month, we pick a name, and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab. It's right there at the top of the page.
And we do know that we are delinquent. We are past the end of the month. We promise that After Hours is coming next week. We'll have the Listener's Choice review of Brief Encounter, excerpts from the Film Spotting Chicago meetup, and a lot more. We'll announce the next Listener's Choice winner as well and give out some Film Spotting swag.
We have to give out. We've been so delinquent. We need to give out more prizes, and we will this time.
So look for that Tuesday or Wednesday next week. We do appreciate your patience. The unforgiving mood. This can't be erased. You're left wondering about what may have been. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and it's time now for our fall movie preview. We're going to give you our top five most anticipated fall movies. We're including in that, I believe, Maddie, holiday films right up to Christmas or not?
No, I found enough good ones just in September and October alone.
I almost just went with my films through Thanksgiving. I don't know why I decided to change it, but I am looking forward to seeing what is on your list, what movies you are really excited about. I know for me, I'm not including, obviously, anything I saw in Toronto that I may have mentioned in the previous segment recapping my favorite films from that festival. So no Toronto movies there. Maddie, what is your number five?
Well, for my number five, let's go ahead and hear a clip.
My name is Bobby. I am descended from an ancient line of proud warriors. My ancestors went into battle alongside Aztec soldiers. Today, we move within the inner circles of the wealthiest and most powerful people on the planet. Who am I? Question is, what am I? I'm a Chihuahua.
Adam, I am constantly on the lookout for documentation that our society is doing itself in so much faster than both the dinosaurs and the Romans. I think I might have found Exhibit A in Beverly Hills, Chihuahua.
Are you serious?
From director Raja Gosnell, whose dossier includes being at the helm of Scooby-Doo 2, Home Alone 3, and actually I'm totally being unfair to him because before serving as a director, he did work as an editor on some very, very solid films. Beverly Hills Chihuahua centers around a pampered talking chihuahua, think Paris Hilton, that gets lost in Mexico and has to find her way back. I actually think the premise looks inviting if you were making a 2-minute Saturday TV funhouse, but I'm guessing an hour and a half of this thing will do more harm than good. But I, for one, cannot wait for October 3rd. And this movie, I believe, from Disney.
Well, Maddie, I believe you are the only one who cannot wait. And I'm not sure we're going to get a whole segment out of it, but I'm smelling maybe a Maddie's Movie Minute. Maybe you can get a date to go with you.
I can get a date. You betcha.
Yeah, and she's going to want to return one after Beverly Hills Chihuahua. Well, for me, my number five, this is my Across the Universe memorial pick for this season, where it's either going to be a train wreck or it's going to be brilliant. And it is a movie called The Soloist that comes out around Thanksgiving. Here's the story, basically. A writer, kind of a down-and-out writer, discovers a homeless schizophrenic man who used to be a musical prodigy and is a great violinist, and it just sounds awful if you just go off that premise alone. But Robert Downey Jr. is the writer, Jamie Foxx is the schizophrenic man, the prodigy, and Joe Wright, the director of Atonement, which I love so much from last year, is the director. So, I don't know. I'm giving those people the benefit of the doubt.
Too many chefs, my friend.
Maybe so.
All right, well, my number four is Body of Lies from Ridley Scott. We were lukewarm on his last film, American Gangster, safe to say, which, of course, teamed up Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe. Now he teams up Crowe with Leonardo DiCaprio. Your dreams have finally come true, mm-hmm. Adam. Three very interesting men. I respect their work. I'm curious to see their take on the Washington Post's David Ignatius's novel about a CIA operative tracking a terrorist in Jordan. I'm sure, Adam, it will be dripping with machismo from start to finish. It comes out October 10th from Warner Brothers.
Yes, it does. And actually, Body of Lies, the awfully named Body of Lies, which instantly conjures up a bad Madonna film for me, Body of Evidence, of course. That is my number four pick as well, and I'm calling this my Fracture Memorial pick because that's another film last year
I
got all excited
about. Fracture?
Oh, it was in my top five.
No.
I couldn't wait to see Fracture because it had Anthony Hopkins in it and Ryan Gosling.
You are a pie-in-the-sky optimist, my friend.
Two titans, I thought, going up against each other in this tense-looking, solid thriller, and it was an absolute disaster as far as I'm concerned. Here you've got, though, Ridley Scott, as you mentioned, who has been average lately, I'd say, with American Gangster and with Kingdom of Heaven, but I still give him some credit. And then you do merge DiCaprio and Crow, two of my favorite actors, this terrorism thriller. It sounds really good. I'm being a little bit reserved in my excitement because, as we said, Ridley Scott has let us down a little bit here recently, but I still am excited about this awful Skinamax-sounding film, Body of Lies, October 10th.
All right, well, my number three, let's break the ice,
Really?
Yeah, I think my curiosity to see this thing is probably the same impulse that gets me into Ripley's Believe It or Not to see The Shrunken Heads. The buzz about this film is absolutely all over the place. An early leaked version of the script, if it was real, apparently read like an absurdist comedy. In an already heated election year here in the States, this thing is going to be a lightning rod. I'm sure Bill O'Reilly is already working on his material. And you know me, I always want to be a part of a maelstrom. So that's why Lionsgate and Mr. Oliver Stone get my money on October 17th.
Did not make my list, but one I am very curious to see. And it will be interesting to see how it plays out.
Talk about a train
effect.
Wreck. Talk about a possible
it
train wreck.
Yeah. But in terms of the election, Religious, the new Bill Maher film, is another movie I saw in Toronto and had some discussions with some critics afterwards. And there is a little bit of a fear that movies like Religious, like Oliver Stone's W, are going to backfire, like Fahrenheit 9/11 did in some ways, and just motivate the Republican
exactly.
base.
Exactly. It's going to end up causing a lot of blowback.
Yeah, it really could. Well, my number three, it comes out Christmas Day. Let's hear a clip.
My name is Benjamin Button, and I was born under unusual circumstances. While everybody else was aging, I was getting younger, all alone.
That is the trailer from The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, about a man who ages backwards. It is directed by David Fincher, the great David Fincher, adapted from F. Scott Fitzgerald. The cast has Brad Pitt, Kate Blanchett, Tilda Swinton, Elias Koteas, who I like a lot. And, you know, I'm not big on Brad Pitt, as you know, Maddie. And the last time Pitt played a character like this, someone outside the realm of the normal, we got Meet Joe Black, which was a disaster. So I'm trying to overlook that fact and just focus on the story sounds interesting, the cast sounds really good, and of course with David Fincher at the helm, I will see anything he makes. So that's my number three.
All right, well, my number two is Zach and Miri Make a Porno. I was never a huge Kevin Smith fan at all. I didn't love his films because I never quite bought into his aesthetic, films like Clerks and Mallrats and Chasing Amy. But Clerks 2, honestly, is probably the last drop-dead funny movie experience I've seen, and I'm eager to see what he does here. Seth Rogen and Elizabeth Banks are in need of rent money, so they decide to make a porno to raise money. I will see this movie if for no other reason the original poster was banned here in the United States. I think we should put a link to it on our website. On principle alone, this movie gets my money. The Weinsteins and MGM brave enough to roll this one out, I believe, on Halloween.
If you can find it, Maddie, I will link to it in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net. Another one I am very much looking forward to seeing. Like you, Clerks 2 reinvigorated my interest in Kevin Smith, and I'm very curious about it, though you did not like Seth Rogen at all. In fact, we're very hard on Seth Rogen, said you were very tired of Seth Rogen after Pineapple Express. What gives? Have you guys kissed and made up?
I believe in second chances. He is on notice, though.
He is on notice. Okay, well, my number two, I'm going to be shocked, Maddie, if this one doesn't come up at least as an honorable mention here from you, and that is the new Gus Van Sant film, Milk.
If homosexuals are allowed their civil rights, then so would prostitutes or thieves or anyone else.
40 years old, and I haven't done a thing. I'm not going to be forced out of San Francisco by social deviants and incorrigibles.
We need one of our own in office.
We could have a revolution here.
I don't do losing.
There she is, our new campaign manager.
Milk comes out November 26th, and if Gus Van Sant does it right, he may have two movies in my end-of-the-year top five, along with Paranoid Park. Sean Penn, of course, playing the first openly gay public official, Harvey Milk. I've been excited about this movie, as I name drop here. Maddie, you can pick the name up off the floor. Todd Haynes, the director, mentioned to me that this was a done deal back when I interviewed him last November. Got very excited about this film. We watched the documentary, The Times of Harvey Milk, of course, here on the show as part of our documentaries marathon. It's got a great-looking cast, not only with Penn, but Emil Hirsch, Josh Brolin, Diego Luna, James Franco. Cannot wait for this film.
Well, I can't wait either. It's not on my list because it actually comes out in November.
Right.
And people, this has been a great year for movies because originally I was going to include holiday films, including Thanksgiving in December, but then I was able to whittle it down. I actually had so many to choose from just the upcoming 2 months.
Okay, well.
And the one I'm most looking forward to is this one.
Tim Boyle, Daily News.
You're clean as a board of health. You got no debts, no enemies, 4 years in the service.
Look at this, a Purple Heart. What the hell is this?
This thing ain't normal.
$5 million. That's so much that statue had withdrawn in the black market. What's it doing buried there on the bottom of your closet?
One of my all-time favorite directors, probably my favorite working right now, I think Spike Lee says more in a single one of his movies than most directors do in their entire lifetimes. I, for one, am really glad to see him branching out in terms of the material he's been drawn to recently. I think he fell under really undue criticism for Inside Man for not making a quote-unquote Spike Lee joint. His trademarks were all over that film.
There were, you're
and
right.
And he is as fiery and outspoken as ever in doing his press events leading up to this film, Miracle at St. Anna, which is getting me really, really excited and leads me to believe that this movie will be so much more than a quote-unquote war film. Can you imagine Spike Lee, coming off a movie that made $300 million with Inside Man, he had trouble getting funding for this film,
right,
which tells the story of a group of African-American soldiers trapped behind enemy lines in Tuscany. I really, really cannot wait for this film.
Yeah, it was one I was really hoping to catch up with in Toronto, and unfortunately the schedulers this year of the press and industry screenings just did a terrible job. On Saturday morning, you had to decide between whether you were going to see the Egoyan film or the Spike Lee film or the Linklater film. It was very hard to choose which one you
were going to see. You can't ask Kepinar to make a Sophie's Choice like that.
No, it was impossible, so I missed it. Do want to catch up with it here very soon. Of course, we will discuss it here on the show. My number one, it also comes from the territory, the realm here after Thanksgiving, Maddie, that you didn't include, but it is The Road, the adaptation of the Cormac McCarthy novel. Nothing like a good bleak post-apocalyptic thriller for your post-turkey entertainment needs, Maddie. You've got Cormac McCarthy, who wrote, of course, the book No Country for Old Men, Viggo Mortensen, an actor I absolutely love, and I've been reading this book now, The Road, off and on for 6 months, and I love it. Really, I can almost say it's one of my favorite books ever.
Is that
but here's
a good
why.
Thing? Is that a
here's
good
why.
Thing?
Yeah, because here's why I haven't been able to finish it. It's too depressing, I'm too busy, and I'm not sure I want the book in my mind the whole time I'm watching the film. As soon as I heard that the movie was coming out and got really excited, I decided to shut it down, and I wasn't going to read any more of it. And I keep finding myself wanting to open it back up, and then I hold back because I just want to take the movie for what it is. Guy Pearce and Bobby Duvall are also in it. So The Road is my number one most anticipated fall movie.
All right. Well, do you have any honorable mentions?
I do have a few that made your list. Miracle at St. Anna, Zach and Miri Make a Porno, and Australia. I have to throw that out there because I know many of our listeners are excited. It's getting all this buzz. Everyone's thinking it's going to be a Best Picture nominee from Baz Luhrmann, who made Moulin Rouge and Romeo and Juliet. I believe Hugh Jackman, Nicole Kidman are in this film. So I'm curious about it. It's an honorable mention there. I did not have, though, Maddie, Che, the new Steven Soderbergh film, which I missed in its four-hour-plus glory at Toronto. It played after I left the festival, unfortunately, but it's actually not going to come out until after the first of the year. I decided it didn't count for this list, though it probably would have been my number one otherwise.
Well, you know, we're so huge in Melbourne, Australia.
We are.
I think we could actually pre-record our review of Australia beforehand.
Maybe so.
We'll just talk up strictly ballroom, all that
stuff.
Yeah,
why not? What about you? Any honorable mentions?
Yeah, I really am looking forward to The Express, which is the story of Ernie Davis, the first African-American to win the Heisman Award, and it was actually filmed here in Chicago. Rock and Rolla, a crime comedy from Guy Ritchie.
Oh, man.
See if you can get it back.
Heard bad things in Toronto.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Bad
great.
Things.
Regulus from Bill Maher.
Yep.
And The Duchess. I'm actually looking forward to this one, starring Miss Keira Knightley.
Wow, I'm surprised that you're excited about that one.
I love my period dramas.
Yeah, you do.
All right, well, those are our top five most anticipated fall movies. We'd like to know which fall movies you're most anticipating. Please vote in our poll question at filmspotting.net. You can also send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. That's feedback@filmspotting.net.
Out new in wide release this weekend, we have the new Coen Brothers film, Burn After Reading, Righteous Kill, the film with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, pairing them together finally after their brilliant showing in Heat. Right, Maddie?
Unfortunately, directed by John Avnet of 88 Minutes.
That's true, John Avnet. We also have Tyler Perry's The Family That Prays and The Women, Annette Bening, in that film, as well as Candy Bergen. I know you're a big Candy Bergen fan, Maddie, so you'll be running out to see that on next week's show. Our plan right now, I believe, is we're going to try and discuss Lakeview Terrace. This is the new film with Samuel Jackson and Patrick Wilson's in it. It's from Neil LaBute, his new movie. And also, we got to squeeze in a few minutes on Righteous Kill, John Avnet or not, just to see Pacino and De Niro together. So we will get to that. I think we're going to do our top five actor pairings we most want to see in honor of Pacino and De Niro being reunited. I'm not sure if we're going to get to the first film, Look Back in Anger, in our Angry Young Men marathon or not. We may have to hold off on that one a little bit, but that marathon is coming soon.
Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable assistance and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. Special thanks to Tori Malatia and Steve Edwards at Chicago Public Radio, along with Golden Joe Dassault for his great production help, and to Ari Hest for this week's music. Learn more at arihest.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Bice from Spout.com. I co-host Film Couch, Spout's weekly podcast. Be sure to check out blog.spout.com for full coverage of the Toronto International Film Festival, including interviews with Brad Pitt and John Malkovich from the Coen Brothers' new film Burn After Reading, Gerard Butler, star of Guy Ritchie's new film Rock and Rolla, and Adria Petty, director of Paris Not France, the documentary about Paris Hilton. Also, we've got the straight story on the distribution plans for Steven Soderbergh's four-hour epic about Che Guevara, starring Benicio del Toro, reviews of Treeless Mountain, 35 Rums, and many, many more. Also, be sure to listen to the latest episode of Film Couch, available on Spout.com and iTunes, where Kevin Kelly and Karina Longworth share stories about Toronto, including a story about watching Burn After Reading in a nearly empty theater with an annoying guy who kept making quips at the screen, and that guy turned out to be Adrian Brody. We also talk about Tarsem's The Fall, a stylized surrealist epic new to DVD, and I interview Michelle Boyd, executive director of IFP. She tells us what's in store for the 30th annual Independent Film Week happening in New York over the next week, formerly called the Independent Film Market. And if you're in the area, go check it out. Spout's own Paul Moore is speaking on a couple of panels.
Promos are done. DVDs and donations.
DVDs and donations.
Should be. We've got, we got 15 minutes. Which should be enough.
Let's do it, man. Okay. Let's do it, man. Let's do it, man.
Here we go.
Let's do it, man. Hey, man. Hey, man. Hey, let's do it, man. Let's do the DVDs, Adam. You bring those DVDs, Adam.
Okay, I'm going. Shut up. Let's get out of here.